Pull up a chair, make yourselves comfy, and let's talk guitars. Hi, this is Cams, and welcome to another episode of Acoustic Guitar IO. A few months ago, it was my great privilege and pleasure to sit down and have a conversation with UK guitar player Gordon Giltrap. We chatted for a good half hour about all things guitar. Without any further ado, here's Gordon Giltrap. Hello everybody, welcome to another episode of Acoustic Guitar IO. We're once again in the beautiful library of Spring Hill Manor, in the Cotswolds, and I'm joined this morning by the wonderful Gordon Giltrap. Welcome to the show, Gordon.
Thank you, Kems. Thank you for calling me wonderful.
You played a fantastic set last night, Gordon. It was a great pleasure to watch you play.
Thank you. That you're very kind. It was a little bit late for me, as I'm getting on in years a bit. Your concentration was slipping a bit, so I apologised to the assembled company for that, but everybody was very gracious and very kind.
Well, that just shows people like me that you're human and that when we make mistakes, it's okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it happens.
I make a lot of mistakes, but they're good ones, I think.
So you've obviously been involved with the guitar for quite some time.
A depressingly long time, yes. It's 50 years this year.
Wow.
50 years since I started my career as such. I kind of date it back to when I signed my first recording contract, which was in 1966 at the tender age of 18. And my first album came out in 68.
Okay.
And you look back on that, you think, wow, how did that happen?
Well, I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm 25 years this year.
Okay.
After having seen the Acoustic Roots documentary about the wonderful Bert Jansch.
Was it really 25 years ago?
1992, that was first aired.
Yeah, I remember watching it.
Yeah, and that was what sent me out to buy my first guitar.
And had you played the guitar before then?
I'd played piano accordion up until the age of 12.
Okay.
And then there was a long gap.
So that's a good grounding in music, though, theory and stuff, yeah?
I had some of that, yeah. So you were a contemporary of Bert Jansch.
I came along on their coattails. I came along on the coattails of Bert and John, although it was only a few years. When you're younger, it feels like many years. Because Bert's first album came out in 1965. And my first album came out in 68. So it's not a long gap. And I signed with Transatlantic in 66. But really, Bert Jansch and John Rembaum were the established names. They were the guitar gods within the acoustic field, along with Davy Graham, of course.
Yes.
And I would regularly worship at the throne. And even many years on, I would be in their company, or I would still be in awe of them. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. And Bill Leader, I believe, was the producer
Bill Leader.
Of your first album.
Bill Leader, the legendary record producer. I said to Bill once, I said, you discovered me, Bill. I said, I owe you so much. He said, no, Gordon, you discovered yourself, which I thought was rather nice. But yeah, he was like a father figure to me. He took me under his wing and was very patient with me. I was a very young, intense 18-year-old and wanted to make it, and very insecure. And I just said to Bill, do you think I'll do it, Bill? Do you think I'm good enough? Yes, you'll be fine, Gordon. You'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Lovely man. I say legendary because I think he was the first person to record Davy Graham. Certainly the first person to record Angie. Mm-hmm. And was around at the very beginning of the what we know as the British folk scene.
Yeah.
When a relatively unknown Bob Dylan came over. And I think Bill was hosting him along with Bert.
Wow.
The interesting story, that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe from the documentary, Bob Dylan was here in London to star in a play.
He was. He was in a play. And in the play, he just played harmonica. Uh-huh. And his His stage name then was Blind Boy Grunt. Yeah, that was his stage name. Yeah, he came out purely, literally to be in a play.
Uh-huh.
I think it was a radio play. But I think obviously whilst he was over here, I think he must have done a few little floor spots here and there.
Yeah. And how was London in those days for performers? What were the clubs like?
Brilliant. You see, when you're there at the time, it's just what it is. You don't think it's anything that special because it's what it is or what it was. There was venues all over the place. And it was the Soho was such a buzzing place. You had three major clubs. You had the Les Cousins in Greek Street is where I managed to get a residency. And that was really something. If you got a residency at Les Cousins, you really thought you'd arrived. Even though maybe only six people would turn up on a Wednesday night to see you, you felt like it was a rite of passage. And I would share a Wednesday night with John Martin one Wednesday. The following week, it would be a duo called the Sally Angie. And the Sally Angie featured a brother and sister called Mike and Sally Oldfield.
Oh.
So young Mike Oldfield.
Okay.
So they were heady days. The other club, of course, was the Troubadour in the Old Brompton Road, which in its own way had its own history, probably a longer history than the Cousins. And you would have people like Paul Simon playing at the Troubadour. I was down Les Cousins one night and Paul Simon dropped in and did a floor spot. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Playing material from an album called Bookends. That was Al Stewart's night. And I remember standing at the back and Paul walked down the stairs with a lady called Judith Piepe. Judith Piepe was a social worker in the East End of London. And when Paul was starting out, this is all well documented, but when Paul started out over here in the UK and when Art Garfunkel came over, they used to stay at Judith's flat in Cable Street in the heart of the City of London.
Mm.
And obviously he was over visiting and he came down the stairs. I looked up, I thought, oh my God, it's Paul Simon. And he came down and he stood next to me. So I was sandwiched between him and another very famous singer-songwriter called Roy Harper.
Ah.
So they were having a conversation across me.
Uh-huh.
And I thought to myself, Gordon, remember this. I think this is significant. I think this is a special moment. Make the most of this. Something to tell your grandchildren. But that's what the Cousins were like. And the other club was called Bunges. And Al Stewart regularly would play at Bunges and a lot of other people. But the Cousins was the place that you would have Bert and John playing regularly, Jackson C. Frank.
Uh-huh.
I went down there one night midweek and there was a band on and the guitarist was John McLaughlin.
Right.
And there's only about half a dozen people in the audience. Another time I dropped down, there was a band on stage. I thought, these are a bit good. And they were the Incredible String Band.
Right.
Did a floor spot. You know, so, it was that kind of place. Cat Stevens was around a lot. It is alleged that Jimi Hendrix turned up one night at an all-nighter at the Cousins and played.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you think that compares now with the gigging scene, the live music scene?
You can't compare it, really. You can't compare it because the music business has changed drastically. In those days, I sound like an old age pensioner, because I am. I turned 70 this year. In those days, if you got a deal with a record company, they would work with you over a three-album period. So the plan was you do a first album to establish yourself or to get known. The second album would be a bit more known. The third album, it would establish you as an artist. So, you know, they were prepared to work with the artist, and the money wasn't the main agenda then.
Yeah.
And there was a degree of longevity, you know, they believed in. So if you sign with the right label, I mean, everybody that signed with Island Records became incredibly famous.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody really that had a failed career as far as I know. I was with Transatlantic and I signed with them because my heroes were there.
Yeah.
They were with the label and I thought, this is the label to be with. You go into the offices there, it's like walking on hallowed ground because Bert Jansch had walked through that space and John Renbourn. Yeah. It was different. It was a golden age. It was a golden age of music. It was a golden age of live performance. And it was a golden age for the guitar. Because certainly I honed my craft around the clubs of London in the early days. And certainly in the Cousins. It was exciting. It was exciting. Yeah. And there wasn't so much ego. There was kind of healthy competition, but there wasn't as much ego there. And everything went, you know, it was okay. You could get up there and do whatever you wanted. Nobody cared because music was a great melting pot. But that was the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
It was a great time.
But that was a great period of evolution of guitar playing, some might say, when some of the blues influences from America came across, and it seemed to grow up around London at that time, style of playing.
It did. And obviously Bert and John picked up on, you know, I think the term folk blues was coined around about that time, probably from Davy Graham with his album Folk Blues and Beyond.
Ah, okay.
And so you'd be embracing this music and trying to write stuff like it, and then you'd say, "Oh yeah, well I'm a folk blues artist." You know, I was as far away from blues as anybody could be, but I certainly embraced it and was influenced by the people that were the real deal. And as far as I'm concerned, Bert was the real deal, and so was John. I mean, John Renbourn used to play slide guitar. Listen to the first album,
right?
He used to play a bit of bottleneck stuff, yeah.
And besides the folk boom, there was another large influence in your life, a certain Pete Townsend.
Yes, yeah. You see, but looking back on it, it's all related, because Pete was, all that stuff that he was doing with The Who was influenced by the blues musicians, people like Howlin' Wolf, and it was very much acoustic based. I mean, Pete is a great acoustic guitarist, and everything that he wrote in those days was based around the acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Tracks like Substitute was written around a harmony 12 string.
Yeah.
You know, so you got these acoustic guitars jangling away in the background. So therefore, yeah, I would be influenced by his approach to the guitar, his charisma, his excitement, his anger, if you like, his intensity. And I was influenced by that, because he is a Londoner. I was a Londoner. I was from the South. He was. The other part of town, you know, where was it? Where was he from? White City, around that way, where The Who were based. And so I used to watch Ready Steady Go, and I was intrigued by this guy with the big nose playing this incredible stuff, this excitement. Yeah, I picked up on that. Still there. I had a great pleasure of meeting Pete last year, actually. That was a moment for me.
Uh-huh.
A lovely man, very gracious man. A genius, towering genius.
Wow. And did you travel much in those days with your music?
Only the UK, really. I didn't go abroad very much. And even now, I've never been a person to go abroad with my stuff. It was always around the UK. Yeah, I would travel the length and breadth of England and then venture into Scotland, but not often. Mainly England, Wales. Well, there was quite a happening music scene in Wales, but Scotland became quite big for me when I was doing the big time stuff, when Heart Song got in the charts and I was doing the prog rock thing. And I can tell you this, not just because I'm sitting in front of a Scot, not to be patronising, but my most memorable gig was at the Glasgow Apollo, Green's Playhouse. I mean, that audience, somebody said to me once, look, they're either going to love you or hate you, but if they love you, believe me, you'll know it. They'll let you know. And they did. Yeah. I came on stage, I thought I was God. Yeah. I really thought I was something special.
Glasgow crowds still
have that.
Because
they made me feel special.
Yeah. One of my favourite venues to go and watch music is the Barrowlands. Barrowlands Marketplace.
Yeah,
the
I know Barrowlands,
The big ballroom. And it's spit and sawdust, sticky floors and... Great, great, great crowd.
It's absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a great thing about, I suppose, Scots generally, but Glaswegians are very down to earth, are very grounded people. Mm. They never get above themselves, and they certainly wouldn't allow you to get above yourself. And I think that's great. And I've seen that with other friends of mine who've remained grounded. Midgeur, for example, is a Glasgow lad, as you know.
Mark Knopfler.
Yeah, born in Glasgow.
Born in Glasgow.
But born up in the northeast. Yeah. Born in Glasgow, but yeah.
Have you ever met Mark?
No, I haven't. No. I never met Mark. We communicated via email a couple of times. He said he liked what I did, which was nice, bit of an ego massage there. Yes. I have a connection with Mark because one of my good friends is a man called Steve Phillips. And Steve Phillips was in a duo with Mark when he first came down to Leeds as a junior reporter, because he was a journalist, you know, Mark Knopfler.
Mm.
And he met up with Steve Phillips and they formed a duo playing national guitars. And Steve Phillips had a profound effect on Mark and introduced him to all that country blues stuff, the real deal. Because Steve was certainly, and still is, one of this country's finest blues musicians. And then he formed a band with Mark called the Notting Hill Billies. Do you remember Notting Hill Billies? Yeah, well, that was Steve's thing. And they're still very good friends. And Steve's a lovely man, incredibly talented. He's a brilliant guitar player, brilliant blues musician, builds the most amazing guitars. He's a landscape artist. His father was a sculptor. His father was a head of art at Leeds College of Art. And the very first Dire Straits album, there's a track called In the Gallery. Do you know that track?
No.
The first album? And it was a song that Mark wrote about Steve's father.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, about being the ignored artist, you know. Yeah. So that's my only connection with Mark. But when I'm with Steve, we don't chat about Mark very much. I usually chat about Steve, what he's up to.
Yeah.
Because I admire him so much.
Now, you've brought with you this weekend a rather special-looking guitar from Filed Guitars.
Yes.
Is this your new signature model?
Yeah, Roger and I were chatting about this. I've been playing Filed Guitars since 1972. And really, the Filed Guitar is the, if you like, the musical backdrop to all the most significant albums that I made in the 70s, from Visionary onwards. And, you know, you can hear that Filed Guitar in the back, you know, on those tracks. And about 15 plus years ago, Rogers decided it was time for the company to do a signature model. And he chose me as the first artist to do the signature model. Of course, I was very honoured and flattered and very touched by that. And we thought, well, 15 years on, why don't we do a newer version, but this time with different woods. And the woods we're using this time are maple, flame maple back and sides, and cedar for the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives a very, very bright, clear, beautiful, lyrical sound. The first model was a spruce top with rosewood. Okay. And that's a great guitar. But I've never played a bad Filed yet. They're all outstanding instruments.
That's interesting, because the other artist that was booked to play at this gathering, he's also a Filed guitar player.
Yes, Will McNichol. Will McNichol. The wonderful Will McNichol. What a fabulous player.
Oh, yes.
Fabulous young player. And what a sweet, sweet man. Great player. Great. And a fine composer. His compositions are sublime.
And he's young.
Yeah.
Darn it.
Yeah, he's young. But when you get to our age, everybody's young. Well, my age, not yours.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, you look at these people, guys, thought he's young, you know. And then you sort of think, well, I was 18.
Yeah.
And I'm still playing a piece of music I wrote when I was 18. So it just reminds me that I must have had something that was significant enough for Bill Leader to say, yeah, let's work with this kid. I think he's got something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the new wave of acoustic guitar players now coming up, I find it quite amazing to watch another acoustic uprising and evolution of style and content.
It's astonishing that I think the playing has become very clever. That's any word I can use. Very skilled and very clever. The only thing I would say is that I think a lot of those players, those great players, they go through a phase of being influenced by these percussion players, the tappers.
Yes,
you know, and that's great. To actually acquire that technique and that coordination. I don't know how they do it. I couldn't do it. But then you've got to then have a tune.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be something melodic and memorable about the composition within that. So if they can combine the two, then they've cracked it.
Yeah. That's interesting you say that, because that's my opinion as well.
Yeah. I mean, I chatted to Clive Carroll about it. I mean, Clive is probably one of the finest guitarists in Europe.
I would say so.
You know, yeah. and his, you know, his compositions are sublime. The man's a genius. But we've often spoken about this. He said, yeah, he said that tapping thing's not my thing. It doesn't appeal to me. He could do it. Imagine if Clive Carroll decided to be a, you know, he'd be the best, wouldn't he?
He would.
Yeah. If that's what he wanted to do. But I think we come from a more of an old school traditional approach to playing the guitar and writing tunes. Mm. That's what turned me on to the playing of Burt Jansch and John Renbourn. John, probably more so than Burt, because John had this incredible ability to write these sublime melodies that were otherworldly and were part of the Renaissance. Burt wrote these amazing songs that had incredible poetry to them, and his guitar playing would be very haunting and very different.
Yeah.
You know, totally different to John, completely different players. Both painting different pictures. That's the way I compare guitar players now. You know, we're all painting different pictures. So you can't compare a Picasso to a Leonardo da Vinci painting, you know, or a Salvador Dali. We're all painting different pictures and all hopefully communicating in the same way.
Yeah. And telling stories.
Yeah.
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 And composition-wise, how do you come up with a composition? Does it just come to you from the air, or do you put your guitar in a certain tuning and see what
you know,
comes up?
I wish I knew. Every day I'm so grateful. A, so grateful to still be here. Still grateful to still be able to play as well as I can at my age. And very grateful that nature has given me a gift to write these tunes. I don't know where they come from. It's a desire for melody, that's for sure. And that would be from listening to Burt and John, and also classical music, the English school of classical music, people like Vaughan Williams and Elgar and Gerald Finzi, these great melodic players. You know, you've got to have a good tune. So I come from that tradition, I suppose. But when I compose, I come up with an idea, and what can spark that idea can be a guitar effect. It could be I could be working with a delay pedal or a really great sounding guitar that inspires me, an open tuning using partial capos, getting at the germ of an idea and then seeing where that idea will lead you. You have to follow the idea.
Yeah.
You can't push it. And I think most of the composers I know would be the first to admit that the best stuff that they've written, they haven't really thought about it. And all the good stuff comes from a place of non-ego. It comes from a place of not thinking about it too much, not having an agenda. And I've written a lot of clever pieces, well-crafted, clever, tricky pieces that appeal probably just to guitar players, but I want to appeal to people that are more than just guitar players.
Yeah.
And the stuff that has really touched people is the stuff that isn't that technically demanding, or I don't find it so, but has a very strong melodic and emotional content, and that comes from another place. It's a higher, and it sounds a bit airy-fairy, but it does come from a higher form of consciousness.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff I've written, usually late at night, it's when you're tired, the ego drops away, and the pure stuff comes through. It's getting to that point, getting to that moment, you let the pure stuff come through. And then when you finished it, you say to yourself, how did I do that? I can't remember writing that bar of music, or how did that come about? And the other thing you must remember, and this is a message to anybody that's creative, is fortunate enough to have a creative gift, is that when you've written it and it's good, don't take the credit for it, because it comes from somewhere else. Don't say, oh, this is good because I'm so damn clever and I'm a genius. Yeah. It comes from somewhere else.
That's a nice message.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, it does come from somewhere else. So just always remind yourself of that, because it can be taken away from you within an instant. So treasure it all the while you've got it and can still do it.
Yeah. That's one of the great things about gatherings such as this one. Everybody's egos get left at home and we all come together to sharing music and friendship? Yeah,
I do. I do once every 2 months. I do a sharing day. I call it sharing day, mm-hmm. because I think it's what it is. I did have a friend who wanted to create a thing called the Gordon Giltrap Guitar Academy. And I thought about it. I thought, that's a bit highbrow for somebody who left school at 15 and can't read a note of music. You know, that's a bit, I think that would put people off. Because my job as a musician and as a teacher, because that's what I want to do more and more, is to inspire. So if I can inspire somebody with my performance, with my music, and the imparting of that knowledge to that person so they can go on to create greater stuff than me, you know, that's my job as a teacher, mm-hmm. to inspire other people to go on to do greater things, or to just enjoy it, to find some kind of peace within the moment of the solitude of playing the guitar and just being lost in the sound of it and the meditation of it. Mm-hmm. Because that's what it is. Yeah. It's a meditation. You know, it's a wonderful thing.
Indeed. And mm-hmm. having watched you play and having spent the weekend here, I will have enough inspiration in my bank for weeks to come when mm-hmm. I get back home.
Well, I've got to tell you, Cams, that there's nothing more nerve-wracking than you're playing in front of a room of guitar players that you know are all great players. And they've all got it technically down. They know how to do the stuff. They know how to do that technique and the opportunities. There's nothing you can teach them or show them that they don't know already, because mm. they've spent a lifetime doing it to the same degree that you have.
Yeah.
So all you can do is to share it. Say, this is what I do. Do you like it? But it isn't. It is quite nerve wracking, and it's very, very hard to get that insecurity and that ego out of the way, and just say, okay, this is what I do. Yeah. I thought I'd grown out of it, but I haven't. There's still that nervousness when you're playing in front of guitar players.
Well, that's interesting. I shan't wait too long for myself to grow out of it. Because I do suffer from the same affliction.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of my great pleasures yesterday to accompany you on your composition that I thought was delightful.
Thank you. That's very
kind. It was lovely. And what I liked about it was you started off, was it 4-4? Did it start off in 4-4? Then it changed. The time signature changed.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
And that was lovely. And I thought, yeah, this is good, because it's a conversation. You're starting off with that section, then you're just going off at a tangent. So you've got the A music and the B music, then you come back to the A music and resolve it. And I thoroughly enjoyed doing it, and I was very mindful of the fact that I was just improvising over what you were doing, and that piece of music is obviously very precious to you, and I was just mindful of the fact that I didn't want to screw it up. And I don't think I did. I just followed what your left hand was doing, and I played all the right notes in hopefully all the right places.
Well, it was a great moment for me to share the stage with you. Thank you for
it. It's a pleasure and a privilege, Cams. I mean that.
So, thank you, Gordon, for sitting down with me this morning. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. If people want to find your music or learn some more about you, where could they go to do that?
Well, I've got a website, which is www.giltrap.co.uk. There's little snippets for various albums on there. There's a link to a website called Lathkill Publications, and a lot of my music is on there that you can download for a couple of quid. The PDFs, if you fancy learning some of the stuff.
Okay.
I'm also very much tied in with an organisation called RGT, which is basically the London College of Music, where a lot of my pieces are now being graded. So I've now become legit.
Okay.
You know, so a lot of my pieces will be graded from like grade 3 up to sort of grade 7 or 8. And they're bringing out a book soon, and I think they're going to call it Graded Giltrap.
Well, I look forward to seeing that, Gordon. Yeah. Thanks again for joining me this morning. Thank you all for listening. It's been Cams with Gordon Giltrap. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview, folks. I'd like to thank Gordon once again for sitting down with me for what was a very humbling experience for me. As I alluded to during the interview, The reason I picked up a guitar in the first place was because I discovered the music of Bert Jansch through the Acoustic Roots documentary, which was first broadcast in 1992. I've been a fan of Bert's ever since then, so for me to have a chance of talking with one of Bert's contemporaries and getting the story on what it was like to be there and to be on Bert's and John Renbourn's coattails was a great privilege and pleasure for me. Not only did Gordon sit down with me and have a great conversation, he also joined me on stage during the Plucky Dip performance, where I got to play one of my own compositions and have Gordon accompany me. The Plucky Dip is one of the great features of the RMMGA gatherings. On the Friday night, the participants all sit down for a meal, during which names get drawn from a hat and duos or trios are formed. And these duos or trios then have the weekend to come together and work on a performance piece for the Plucky Dip performance. And these are played all through the weekend whenever there's a space in the playing schedule. And it makes for some great friendships, some great bonding, as well as some great music. I've had lots of fun playing different Plucky Dips over the years, and it really is one of the best features of the gatherings. If you're in the UK, or even if you're further afield, and you'd like to come and join in one of the most harmonious and friendly gatherings that you can imagine, I highly recommend that you try and get to one of these gatherings. This year's was the 21st UK gathering. It's been in various locations, but it's now based in Moreton-on-Marsh, down in the Cotswolds in England. And it's such great fun. Egos get left at home, as we said during the interview. And people from all walks of life come together to join in friendship and music. It really is a cathartic experience and a wonderful experience that I heartily recommend. If you're able to get to one of these gatherings, I'd love to see you there. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Thanks for listening. If you have any ideas on prospective guests that you think would be a good fit for the show, whether they be musicians or luthiers or anyone involved in the acoustic guitar world, please get in touch and let me know. You can get me on cams@acousticguitar.io. That's CAMS, CAMS. Or you can find me online, acousticguitar.io is the website. And I also publish on the Steam blockchain. So you can find me there at steemit.com/@acousticguitar. That's steemit, steemit.com/@acousticguitar. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.